Did you know that as more people listen to WNYC on the internet, our bandwidth expenses go up? Please do your part to support WNYC's online services. Click the ePledge button to make your gift now. And thanks.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
We've invited Dana R. Fisher, an assistant professor of sociology at Columbia, to tell us about her research into how progressive politics uses political canvassing on today's Underreported. In her book, Activism Incorporated, which is published by Stanford University Press, she claims that the left is outsourcing grassroots outreach by sending paid workers door-to-door. I want to thank her so much for coming on our show. Hello.
Thank you for having me. Hello.
So let's talk about political canvassing in general. How far back does it go?
Well, political canvassing has taken place for decades. There is this different type of canvassing that I talk about in the book, which is fundraising canvassing, that was picked up by progressive causes in the 1970s. And that's the kind of canvassing I focus on. It's fundraising canvassing where people go door to door, stand on the street, asking people for funding to support membership in an organization, and it has exploded.
Is this something that both parties use, all parties use?
This is really more of a phenomenon that's taking place on the left. In contrast, the right tends to focus more on mobilizing friends and neighbors through probably the most well-known thing, which is the 72-hour strategy of the Republican Party.
Uh-huh. So is it effective?
The outsource canvassing?
Yeah.
Outsourcing canvassing is very effective. In fact, it is less expensive and more efficient, but there are some unintended consequences that are quite significant.
Now, you worked for a grassroots campaign in 1990, didn't you?
Yes, I did. The first summer after my first year in college, I spent the summer going door to door raising money for PennPERG, which is the Pennsylvania Public Interest Research Group, and I was working on the Clean Air Act, and it changed my life.
Well, were you being paid the way these other people are, the people you're talking about in the book?
I was being paid. However, at that point, the organization was not outsourcing yet, so I only worked on one campaign for the whole summer. A number of the canvassers I studied during summer of 2003 actually worked on three different campaigns in a week. So that meant that on any given day, they'd be given a T-shirt and say, you're raising money for these guys today.
So they'd have no way of feeling any kind of connection with the person or the campaign that they were fundraising for.
Exactly. And in addition to that, there's less of a connection for the members who are being recruited because they're getting a specific script that's been written by an organization that is aiming to raise as much money as possible.
And you felt, the way you were doing it, that you were making a difference?
I felt like I was making a difference very similar to many of the other young people whom I met in 2003. The problem is, a year later, many of these people felt burned out and turned off to politics. I also didn't want to ever canvass again, but I was still interested in politics, obviously.
But I would assume that most of the people who are going to do this sort of thing are idealistic and young and also are interested in politics.
They certainly are. In fact, they when I did a survey with them about their civic engagement, they were significantly more civically engaged than most young people of the same age across the United States.
What happens with conservative college grads? How do they get involved if they're not doing this sort of canvassing?
There are a number of programs on the right that exist to plug young, idealistic Republicans and conservatives into right-leaning groups. Those groups tend to use the young Republicans, young conservative, et cetera, to plug young people in a way that's paid and long-term. And they're not treating the young people as if they're replaceable cogs. Rather, they're treating them as individual people who have potential future contributions to make to the party.
So this is an entry-level job, in a way.
Exactly, an entry-level job.
You write about something you've called the People's Project. You made up that name, didn't you?
It's a pseudonym, yes.
Why did you have to do that?
Well, originally I had decided to use a pseudonym for them because the organization is one of a handful, and the processes that I studied and I've observed are the same throughout the left. I chose to anonymize them in the book because I also didn't want to cause any stress. There were potential legal threats against me. The organization has come out since in September in the Chronicle of Higher Education, and they have named themselves as the Fund for Public Interest Research. And so they are now publicly known as no longer the People's Project.
My guest is Dana R. Fisher. Her book, Activism, How the Outsourcing of Grassroots Campaigns is Strangling Progressive Politics in America. So this organization, I'll leave them named the People's Project. For convenience, it's also a shorter name.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the organizations it canvasses for?
During summer of 2003, they canvassed for the Sierra Club, the Human Rights Campaign, Save the Children, Greenpeace, as well as a number of state branches of organizations. And you can see that they're not one specific theme. They run the gamut of progressive causes.
So when I find some people canvassing outside of my subway stop, are they likely to be working for this group?
They almost definitely work for either this group or for their for-profit spinoff called Grassroots Campaigns, which now works for the DNC and the DCCC.
Is there a typical political canvasser? Who are the people who are working for the People's Project?
They're young people. The mean age of the sample I studied was 22 years old. 60% of them were enrolled in college at the time. They were predominantly white. They came from relatively affluent backgrounds because they get paid very poorly, and it's very difficult, certainly in New York, to pay rent and also live off of the salary.
Are they generally in support of the issues that they're campaigning for?
They are all progressive. I mean, there was one conservative Christian who was part of the sample, and he was very progressive, but he was also very involved in Bible study. But in general, these are progressive-minded young people who have ideas that they may want to work for politics in the future.
How are they trained?
They have a 2-day training period where they're given a script to memorize. And the process is really about how to bring in the biggest donors rather than learning about the issues they're canvassing for.
So this is a sales job. This is like making cold calls on the phone to businesses and trying to sell them something that they probably don't want.
Exactly. In fact, it's really a marketing job. And the canvassers who were the most successful said they had backgrounds in business or marketing. And they said, well, this is great. I can use what I'm learning and help the environment or help the world at the same time.
Salespeople usually have quotas to meet. Do these people?
They certainly do. And in fact, in order to become staff and to leave a training period, the canvassers are required to make a certain amount, which is quota, and it's determined by the organization they're canvassing for on that given day. And then they are required to meet a certain weekly quota, which is many of the canvassers found that dehumanizing and found that their idealism was being bought.
In fact, it seems to me that if you only progress if you do well as a salesperson, that the cause might very well be losing an awful lot of very, very valuable people because that's not what they do well. They're involved with political issues.
Certainly. I mean, many of the canvassers were extremely interested in politics. They were well aware of what was going on in the political system, but they didn't want to be stopping strangers on the street asking them to give money. And they found it really difficult, and many of them got burned out or, as I said, turned off because this was one of the only entry-level jobs that pays.
How many canvassers did you talk to for this book?
The sample was 115 canvassers that were selected from a random sample of stratified offices around the country. That means I had 6 offices, and I talked to every single person willing to talk to me in the office.
And were most of them eager to talk to you?
Yes, they were. There were 2 people who refused to participate because they were uncomfortable giving personal information.
I'm assuming from what you're saying that most of them were upset with what they were doing.
Well, initially, they loved it. They felt like I did in the summer of 1990. They felt like they were making a difference. Most of them I spoke to within their first 2 weeks of canvassing because the attrition rate's so high that the average life of a canvasser is 2 to 3 weeks.
They burn out that quickly or they just can't make the quotas?
Well, they burn out that quickly and they don't make quota. So it's an interaction effect, I would say. But a year later when I did follow-up interviews with them and I spoke to 2/3 of them, almost every single one of them had very negative opinions about the way they were treated and how they were perceived as replaceable cogs in this machine of progressive politics.
Would they have done better if they had worked for the political party directly or the organization that they were canvassing for?
They would, except for right now, these are considered the entry-level jobs into both the Democratic Party as well as into these progressive organizations. As a college grad, you're seen as not having a lot of skills, and this is one entry point in.
And how much are they being paid?
They're being paid relatively little. I know right now there's a canvassing office in Madison that has been protesting because the canvassers say they're making less than minimum wage. But because they're in a quota-based system, they make as much money as they bring in. They get a percentage above it.
I'm assuming that the reason these progressive organizations have switched to this approach is that it's economically more efficient.
Exactly. It's much more efficient. The question is whether the unintended consequences are very significant and too significant to ignore.
So are they getting good results from this outsourcing?
They're getting good results financially, which means that they're able to recruit members, and then they also create these wonderful mailing lists that then they can keep hitting people up for more money. The problem is that they're burning through a whole generation of potential progressive leaders.
Well, it seems to me that because progressive causes do not raise as much money from the standard sources, they have to do something to get to the person on the street.
They certainly do, but they don't have to advertise these jobs as activism jobs. These young people are recruited off their college campuses, being told that they can be activists in training and they can transition into real jobs in meaningful progressive organizations or in the Democratic Party. And of all the people whom I spoke to, very few were able to make that transition, and only the Human Rights Campaign could report any one of the canvassers that they ever outsourced to coming to work for them.
Do you know how the people who are being canvassed react?
I know that a lot of them find it really frustrating. I know some former canvassers who say when they took other jobs in retail, the people who they spoke to said, "You're one of those people? Oh, I can't believe you stop me every day." But, I mean, certainly they raise money, and sometimes there are wonderful stories of people writing $1,000 checks, so you make quota for the week in one check. But in general, I think a lot of the people who are canvassed find it frustrating. They give money, but they don't create any lasting connections to these groups.
Well, what about the canvassers? Are they working in their home territories?
Some of the canvassers are, but because they're college students, in many cases they're imported for the summer. The directors themselves rely on this idea of geo-flexibility, where they're sent wherever there's a need for them. And in some cases, the canvassers reported that they felt like the organization wanted to keep them disconnected from their friends and their families because they worked harder.
Is this part of a bigger trend in civic engagement? Is outsourcing happening mostly in issue-based politics, or is it being extended to electoral politics as well?
This has extended to across the left through into electoral politics in the past couple of years, so much so that the Democratic Party now has a number of different outsourced canvasses that they're running to raise money and find new Democratic supporters.
Well, what would you suggest? The Democratic Party never raises as much money as the Republican Party. How should they go about trying to get more support?
I think that fundraising is fine. I mean, there's no question that the Democratic Party lags behind. They don't have as many resources as the Republican Party. But this is a very dangerous shortcut because it's bypassing connecting friends and neighbors. And there's a big difference between local connections at the grassroots level and raising money. And I think that maybe these things should be separated a little bit.
Well, you talk about it as a shift from membership to management.
Certainly. I mean, and I use Theda Scotchpole's words here because she spoke about these tertiary organizations that are basically mail-in memberships. And the question is whether getting recruited to support an organization by a canvasser is any different from a mail-in membership. And I would say that it's probably not much different at all.
What's the 72-hour plan?
The 72-hour plan, which now is being called the 72-hour strategy, is the strategy the Republican Party developed to connect friends and neighbors on the ground. And working through pre-existing connections among the Christian Coalition, gun groups, pro-life groups, et cetera, and so forth, friends and neighbors were recruited voluntarily to find other people who would vote for the Republican Party.
And why can't Democrats do this?
They can do it, but the Republican Party has invested about 30 years of time in this infrastructure on the ground. Dean's 50-state strategy is potentially a first step in that direction, but it's not going to be resolved in the next week before the election, that's for sure.
And there are many people in the Democratic Party who don't agree with Dean about this. He's saying we have to do things, even if it means sacrificing some votes, for the long term. And they're saying, hey, here's our chance to take over Congress right now. Let's not use this money in any way other than to get as many wins as we can.
Exactly. And so in many cases, they're using shortcuts such as hired canvassers to do the get out the vote and to turn people out quickly through these shortcuts. The problem is that that doesn't create lasting connections. And while it's hard to make a decision about a trade-off of a short-term electoral victory versus long-term infrastructure, but in the end, without the infrastructure, the Democratic Party will continue to have problems leading.
Well, in the old days, people went clean for Gene and did things of that sort and would go up to New Hampshire and campaign for their person. Goldwater got the same kind of response from young conservatives. Are we more sophisticated these days? Is that why we have changed the approach?
I think that economically, again, it seems to be that the bottom line is that this type of outsourcing of activism or canvassing is more efficient. But the question is whether or not that leads to longer-term electoral successes. Now, importing people from blue states does work, but it doesn't work as well as having a friend or a neighbor calling up and saying, who are you voting for?
And the subtitle of your book is How the Outsourcing of Grassroots Campaigns is Strangling Progressive Politics in America. Strangling?
Well, I would contend that this type of outsourcing is keeping us from making the kinds of local connections that are necessary to create a vibrant civil society on the left.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. Dana R. Fisher is an assistant professor of sociology at Columbia University. Her research aims to understand decision-making and the role of non-state actors in contentious politics. Her first book was National Governance and the Global Climate Change Regime, and now Activism, How the Outsourcing of Grassroots Campaigns is Strangling Progressive Politics in America. It is published by Stanford University Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Starting today, Film Forum is hosting a retrospective celebration of the 10th anniversary of the Soros Sundance Documentary Fund. Bruni Bures, director of the Human Rights Watch International Film Festival, and Gara Lamarche, vice president of the Open Society Institute, he also sits on the board of the Sundance Documentary Fund, are both here to talk about how documentaries can spur social change. And they are joined by filmmaker Antoine Katin, whose new short, There Are Women in Russian Villages, is playing at the Film Forum on Sunday. Antoine's documentary focuses on the lives of two women in rural Russia, where poverty and domestic violence are often part of everyday life. I'm very pleased to welcome them all to this show today. And let's begin with you, Bruni. Is film more powerful or immediate than other forms of media?
Absolutely. I would say documentary filmmaking has changed enormously in the past 10 years, not just with the style and the format that the films are told, the stories are told, but with the approach that the filmmakers, distributors, and, say, human rights organizations like Open Society Institute work with these films to make sure that they achieve the maximum amount of exposure as well as impact.
So, Gara, are there certain stories that just can't be fully captured in print?
Well, I'm not sure there are stories that can't be fully captured in print, but I think that film obviously adds a dimension of immediacy and is a medium that many people respond better to and really get the whole human grasp of things. So these documentaries that we're highlighting in the film festival that starts tonight at the Film Forum, the kind of a sampling of some of the films we've supported through the first Soros and then Sundance documentary funds over the years, at root are powerful stories about human beings, and that's what makes them compelling to people. There's nothing really didactic about them. People learn by really having direct exposure to people's lives and the human rights issues they're facing.
Antoine, your film takes us into the daily lives of two women, a mother and a daughter living in rural Russia. What did you want to communicate about their lives with your film?
Actually, I have to say first a few words about the frame, the context in which it was made, which is one of the numerous activities of Soros. There is the Institute for Social and Gender Policy, and I think they had a great idea of spending money not just on conferences and seminars, but making films. And our film is just one of many films, actually, 10 or, I don't even know, 12 films, which come from Russia and from the former Republic of the Soviet Union. And in our film, what we make is more or less by accident. We just met with those people, and we wanted to show the way they live, the way they cope with life, having fled a husband and a father, which was drinking, which was beating them up and so forth, but still made had 8 children with her, with the woman, with the wife. And we just actually show the way they live, and that was actually the main intention in the beginning. And the fact that we had the proposal of Soros was for us a great impact to start, actually. It was just the beginning of a long story, because we started 2 years ago with the shooting, and we are still on now, actually almost finishing and working on the editing for another film, which will be a long film about them, the same woman, but other characters as well.
Well, the opening shots are of the mother's many children sleeping in the dark, and we hear her describing how each was born. That sets the scene there. You said that you just met her somehow. How do you wind up meeting somebody in rural Russia?
That's just happened to be
wandering down the road.
We actually made another film, which was also kind of related to humanitarian questions about Chechen refugees, and in that village. That's our former film, which is called Life in Peace, and it's mostly about men. And in that village, there was this other family with those women. And when we were making the shooting of the previous film, when we were too tired of the men, we went to have some rest at the women's place. And that's how we got to know them, and that's how we actually met them. And only afterward, a year after, we started to make the film about them. So it's more or less by accident, I would say. But we were immediately touched and interested because it's not so common, actually, to have... It's very common in Russia to have women supporting everything. So the entire society is actually based on women, even I would say among the states at the highest level. But there are so many children, and the life was so interesting and so... how can I say that? It was actually... although they are living really in very poor conditions, and they work as milking cows at the farm, so it's like the lowest level, I would say, in the society in general, and especially here in Russia, their life is still very joyful and exciting. So we wanted to catch that and show it, actually.
How common is this situation? I know that alcoholism is a serious problem, but what about a woman with 8 kids? Is that typical?
No. That's what I was saying. That it's not typical that there are so many children. It's typical that the women are doing everything,
yeah.
And it's the same in the cities. Often the fathers are absent. Either they are not there at all because they have been divorced, or he's not taking a real active role in the life, actually. What we want to say with the film, you can see it in the short film, which will be shown now in New York, but what will be in the longer version will be actually maybe the root of those problems, because it shows actually a paradox that Those women are actually, they are suffering from men. She eventually escaped from the husband. But in the same time, she's raising up, growing up children who will become those weak men again. You understand what I mean?
Yes.
From which they will suffer.
There is a cycle here.
This will be the main theme, actually, of the longer film. Now it's just the one which is now shown is based actually on one day in the life of. We just introduce the characters and so forth. But further, we show more the relationship between mother and sons, and it's actually the working title of the film, Mother and Sons.
Rooney, were most of the films in this retrospective made with a specific goal in mind?
I think that all of these films, actually similar to what Antoine is talking about with his film, were made by filmmakers who were very interested in telling a specific story quite intimately. They weren't just going in to tell a story about street children, spend a few days with the children, say, in Bucharest and Romania, and then leave and make a journalistic piece. I think they were all very much interested in understanding a story, the complexity of a community and a group, by spending a lot of time with them.
And then it's easier for the audience to relate to someone from another culture if they can actually see on film just how they live.
Absolutely. And there's an emotion that comes through filmmaking and video making that really penetrates and affects an audience, I think, is one of the strongest parts of film and video making that doesn't happen with the written word as often.
So you think documentary films are effective tools for social change?
Absolutely.
Well, Gara, have any of the films in the series had a concrete impact?
Yeah. No, they have. I think that first I just want to say that the films that we fund through the Soros Documentary Fund and then the Sundance Documentary Funds are the best ones, the ones that we try to look for and that we try to support, are the ones that are in the intersection of art and social consciousness. Propaganda or stuff that really is an advocacy document and is designed and cooked in a certain way is never very effective and isn't the kind of films we want to fund. People have to pursue whatever truth that they see. The gender montage films, the film we were just talking about the women in Russian villages, is part of an interesting series that OSI does that pairs filmmakers and advocates in the post-Soviet countries, and they all have a social change action agenda built into them. There's a policy thing that advocates then carry through. The Soros Documentary Fund films and Sundance Documentary Fund films generally are not made with a specific policy goal in mind, but we do try to marry them to advocates in the Foundation Network. So Calling the Ghosts, for instance.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you about, because that film actually led to prosecutions.
Absolutely. The ones that Calling the Ghosts, which is one of the first batches of films we funded in 1996, is about the struggle of two Bosnian women for justice for their rapes in a Serbian concentration camp. And after it was at the Human Rights Watch International Film Festival, which is a wonderful outlet, now global, I think, in scope for a lot of these kinds of films, HBO has picked up a lot of them. They did pick up Calling the Ghosts, and it actually helped to raise consciousness and awareness and lead to actual capture and prosecution of people. The same is true of State of Fear, about the Peruvian situation with Fujimori. That's being shown all over the world in countries which are facing transitional justice issues. So, yes, you can really have an impact with the films, but they're best when they're made to tell a story and to tell a truth, and then can be used by advocates to press for change.
But as Gara says, Antoine, these films are not meant to be propaganda. On the other hand, there's an awful lot of editorial choice and personal style that goes into making a documentary. And I'm assuming it's hard sometimes to strike a balance between making a compelling film and staying true to the subject matter.
You see, I'm actually very interested in what they are, your guests are speaking about, and the fact that they are showing this kind of film and our film in New York. For me, it's very exciting, and it's very also surprising in the same time, because my feeling is that on one hand, what Bruni said is right. You have a tendency, some changes in documentary filmmaking because of the technique. It's much easier and cheaper, and almost anyone can take a camera and start working. But on the other hand, there is more and more influence by television, which is almost the only financially supporting system for documentary filmmaking nowadays, and they are usually very formatted, and I would say that the general tendency is more towards this kind of propaganda kind of film. And I have been, for example, in the jury of human rights film festival. There are many of them. There are it's pretty fashionable, I would say, even in countries like in Russia, and some new festivals are appearing. And I was in the Czech Republic. One People in Need, it's called. And in general, the film I saw there were more this kind of reportage type of film. You know what I mean? In where you have a leading commentary, where you have more journalistic facts, social facts, political facts, and so forth. What I am doing is quite the opposite. It's more like Bruni said, more the maybe artistical approach. And of course, there are many challenges in storytelling. But for us, the most important is the main message is the story, is the characters, the way they live, the way they speak, and not our commentaries on them. You know
what I mean? But let me ask both Gara and Bruni, how do you, when you're assessing a film, decide that this film isn't skewed, isn't making a point that may not be 100% true, or moving things around? A number of very popular films in recent years have been accused of moving things out of sequence to make a point.
All films have a point of view, and all filmmakers, I hope, are going to be show their point of view, and that's what can make the film very strong as well. If with all of the films that we've chosen here and that are showing in the series this weekend, beginning tonight with Calling the Ghost, follow individuals, they follow people around who are telling to the camera and telling to the audience their story. If there are facts in some of these films that need verification or clarification, Human Rights Watch, the Open Society Institute can absolutely work with experts to clarify that those facts are correct. But otherwise, these films are telling a point of view, and they are the filmmaker's point of view.
Yeah, and I think the fact that both the Human Rights Watch Film Festival and the Documentary Fund that was first run by Soros and now Sundance are hooked into these networks of either OSI or Human Rights Watch, which have a lot of human rights experience and ability to really assess the essential truth, is a big plus. But I also think what makes these films interesting, and back to the kind of art part of them, is that when they make you think and they tell what may be inconvenient truths. And so they either make you think in the way you take Born into Brothels, which had a very successful commercial run, it ran the Academy Award. Zana Brisky, who we'd given a fellowship to actually before she started the film, to go and work with the children in brothels in India.
Who took photographs.
Who helped the kids become photographers. A lot of people looking at that film, including in our own shop, have mixed feelings about it. What about the rest of the kids? You're not really changing the circumstances of their lives. It's a kind of a rescue mission. It raises all those kinds of issues, and that's fine. People come out of the theater, and they're talking about it, and they have different points of view about it. Iran Veiled Appearances will be shown during the festival. Is an amazing film for anybody who's trying to think about Iran and Iran in the world today. And some of the images you come away with, particularly the younger Iranian men and women and their political attitudes and social attitudes, is a scene where a number of veiled women are jumping out of a plane doing skydiving, will inevitably alter the way you at least broaden your picture of what is going on in Iran.
My guests are Gara LaMarche, Vice President of the Open Society Institute, also sits on the board of the Sundance Documentary Fund, Bruni Burris, director of the Human Rights Watch International Film Festival, and Antoine Katin, film director. His new short, There Are Women in Russian Villages, is playing as part of a retrospective celebration of the 10th anniversary of the Soros Sundance Documentary Fund, beginning today at the Film Forum, but his film will be shown on Sunday. And Bruni, Antoine mentioned that television is where most of these films are shown, but we've been seeing more and more films in theatrical distribution in recent years. An Inconvenient Truth fairly recently, Fahrenheit 9/11, do you think that documentaries are becoming more popular with general audiences? When I was a kid, there was often a documentary as part of the regular various films that they would show with the feature film, and that disappeared because everybody said nobody wanted to see them.
I think that's part of the change with the documentaries and these types of documentaries, where there's a story, there's a real storytelling experience that the audience is brought into. And I think what filmmakers and Open Society Institute and Sundance have really acknowledged as well is that you can make a great, the filmmaker can make a great film, but unless there are many things in place for distribution, grassroots distribution, film festivals, film forum, as well as broadcast on television and alternative means of getting the film out there, then no one's going to see this great story.
Well, I don't know whether there's reality television in Russia, but there sure is here, and I wonder if there's any relationship between documentary films and reality TV.
Well, I think this is the ultimate reality television. It sometimes troubles me that we have all these reality shows, and yet there's plenty of reality in these documentaries, and they need to have a broader audience. So what's interesting about the evolution of the fund is that we started out, we're a global foundation, and most of the films funded earlier on were from Eastern Europe and other parts of the world, but always some American films. In much of the rest of the world, the question of distribution and outlet is actually not as hard a question. There are state television often runs documentaries. There's much more access to a wider audience. Typically here, that's not been the case. As you point out, in recent years, well-made documentaries have found a broader audience, and there's much more. Netflix has an arrangement where a lot of these things are available through Netflix. There are film festivals increasingly that highlight documentaries. Indeed, at Sundance itself, the documentary fund that funds the projects in various stages is not the same as the festival. But,
and then we have American Public Television and HBO also supporting it. So there, perhaps it, because there's more airtime to fill, there are also more documentaries, and that means more people will become interested in doing it. What's the situation in Russia, Antoine? Can documentaries get on television?
In Russia, the situation is pretty bad, because in general, I don't know if you have heard of the latest news in general, what's going on in Russia in terms of human rights, in terms of freedom of speech. And unfortunately, the television is showing the worst, actually, of what's going on here in this country. And in that sense, I can say that there is actually no real freedom of speech here in this country, because the main source of information is television. And television will never show, for example, the kind of film we have made, although it's got many prizes in festivals within Russia, all the different documentary film festivals. And some of the one of the main reasons usually is because of the language, because there are those people are cursing. Of course, if you are showing life as it is, you are showing people the way they are. Of course, you have to show the way they speak, and there is a big taboo on this language. But this is just the excuse. Actually, the problem is more political. And what they are showing on television, on Russian television, is actually of very, very low and actually very bad, I have to say, because they show mostly criminalistic research, reportage. As if the main idea would be to say that your life is bad, or you are living in bad conditions, but there are even some worse stories and maniacs and people killing each other. And this is actually what's going on Russian television, unfortunately.
And we have to leave it there, unfortunately, because on Russian television, American radio, there are also time constraints. But my great thanks to you, Antoine Katin.
Thank you.
There Are Women in Russian Villages is playing on Sunday as part of the Film Forum's retrospective celebration of the 10th anniversary of the Soros Sundance Documentary Fund, which begins today with a lot of very important and interesting films. Luckily, they are not censored in this country, although we hope more and more people will go and see them. Bruni Boris is director of the Human Rights Watch International Film Festival. Gary LaMarche is vice president of the Open Society Institute, and also sits on the board of the Sundance Documentary Fund. And it has been my great pleasure to have you all on today's underreported segment. Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.